to judge them with rejecting judgment, which doesn't hurt anybody, which doesn't help anybody. But to acknowledge, that's a lot of the healing in ACA, is to get it straight. What happened and how I had a need to pretend I wasn't hurt in order to survive at the time. We get that straightened out. But if we're working the program and the steps, we'll keep moving ahead. And as we acknowledge that, we acknowledge our part. And you say, what do you mean our part? When you're a little kid, you're going to blame yourself for being negative after they beat you up. You're going to blame yourself for being an iceberg and distant after you were sexually abused. You know, why do that? It's their fault. Fear. That's fear talking. There's no healing going on there. I have a little list of things that, you see, the thing is, when we write down our inventory, our part in the transaction, we're not writing down what we deserve blame for. There's no deserve blame left. There's only a searching for healing, and integral that we cannot be healed unless we take responsibility for our lives. So we own our own feelings and own what we do and kind of stand up with the trust that we're accepted in this group by God and other people, and people will help us walk through and get free of the ways we've handled things. For example, it can be something that isn't a sin or at all. If you're abused, you were the one they hurt. What should you put in your inventory? Well, acknowledge you've been hurt as best you can. Put it straight. But then acknowledging your own part. We might say, I acknowledge that I burdened others with the obligation of making me happy. I just decided that they had to treat me right, or I would never be happy, and it's their fault. Nobody can make us happy. One of the ways we can tell we've assigned someone else the job of making us happy is when we're very deeply disappointed or resentful of the other person. We're holding it against them. God damn it. That person hurt you. That isn't funny. But you acknowledge your hurt and reach, okay, what does a person do after they're hurt that way? Well, they have to acknowledge it. Maybe they have to even tell the person. But we don't have to get them to apologize or change. And we don't have to roll back history and have it not happen. The program says, nobody can stop you from working your program and having a life. Nobody. And we don't have to have rejecting judgment on anyone else, and we're not in the business of giving blameworthy stuff for ourselves. But to say, I'll combine this too. I kind of made a distinction. Maybe they can emerge. But the number two was, we acknowledge that we mess back when they mess with us. You say, well, why should I even mention that? That's so little, you know. I mean, the way I was treated, hardly blame anybody for being distant and negative. Nobody's blaming. But if you are distant and negative as a way of coping and avoiding hurt, you have hurt yourself a lot. And you're in the habit of hurting yourself a lot. And if you can say that's what you're doing, you're one step closer to being set free from that behavior. It's nothing to do with blaming you. That's the way an inventory heals. Also good to acknowledge resentments we have against God. I found out that I resented God for two reasons. I resented him for not making me turn out better. And I resented him for not giving me a bigger payoff for my compliance. You know? I went to the seminary early and I was a good boy. Now. You know? make me good and make me, you know, let's reward. You know, it's a self-centered kind of attitude. Nobody's blaming me and putting me down for being kind of mad at God for not making me turn out better. That's what happens if you get a basic misunderstanding about what the deal is with God, you know. I thought the deal was, you know, that I'd get over everything and finally be all right and have everybody look up to me forever. You can see how this is it's the very heart of this is transformation. It's a woman, very touching to me, this story of a gal who heard this in a pitch, 10-minute pitch. She gave it at a convention. I don't remember the long pitch at all, but her sharing really knocked me out. And in this very brief sharing, she talked about getting sober, and then when she got a little stabilized and started getting in the program, talking to a sponsor, she talked about the way she resented her father. She said, "My father was so bad. He was so cruel and he abused me so much that no way. I mean, me, drop, he's this bastard." And the sponsor said, "Ask God to help you let it go." And she wouldn't even cooperate with that for a little while. Then finally, with the negative feelings, she thought, "Well, okay, I'll give it a shot." So she said, "Okay, I'll let go of the resentment." Then it didn't go. Stuck. Then she said, "Well, I guess you're going to have to pray for him." Pray for him? So the big book suggests we pray for somebody. So she prayed for him. The resentment stayed. Pray for him as you would a sick friend. Prayed, still resented him. The sponsor said, "Okay, after a few more months of that, you'll have to escalate this to the next stage." Now, what is that? "You're going to have to treat him decently." "Oh, no, not that." He lived in the same town still. And he was in contact with the family. And she'd see him once in a while. Couldn't avoid it. She saw everybody else. She said, "You don't have to pretend you like him. You don't just treat him decently. Don't put out negative stuff. If you find it very difficult, but at least be civil and do things decent to him." She'd already done her foot. I think she said to him that, you know, she was hurt and they didn't work. You know, I mean, he didn't respond very well. Okay, so she went on under the heading of treating him decently meant sending him a birthday card, Christmas card, and saying hello when she met him. So she did that for about 4 years and felt a resentment still. He finally got sick and went to the hospital for some surgery or other. And he was in the hospital and she thought, "Well, under the heading of treating him decent, I guess that means I have to go by with a card or a flower or something." And so she went by and did her duty, walked in, put the thing down, said hello. "Hope it get better." Without much feeling, and went down and she said she was getting into her car and realized the resentment was gone. She was in touch with his humanity at last and was no longer under the oppression of his own illness. Her father was sick and couldn't love and lashed out in ways that were awful, but she was set free from his illness by working this program. It's not that we let people off the hook and mollify and say, "Oh, it wasn't so bad." Nothing to do with that. It's cooperating with God to set us free from other people's emotional domination of our lives by keeping us negative. You see how different this is? This is prayerful. This is honest. This requires an atmosphere in which we are given assurance that we're not blamed and rejected. And that it isn't even to our interest to find out we're innocent. You know? You don't get any points for being innocent. You don't get any points for saving God the trouble of healing you. You don't get any. It's just a matter of getting to the truth. Getting to what in us is causing us to snuff out life. What in us is walling me off from being in touch with the humanity of somebody. What in me is preventing me. What in me and my attitude and things I'm, memories and things I'm holding, makes me still vulnerable to the cruelty of another person who lives far away. Or I'm still churning about them. And the big book says, we have a program that'll give you healing from that. And it doesn't come at our time and just the way we want to. Sometimes it'll be 5 years, even while we're applying ourselves steadily. But you know that person, that woman who did that thing with her father, if she did that for 5 years, she's working a hell of a program, you know. And she was still bedeviled by that, and it was still kind of a pain. But still there was a, she was going in the direction. You know? And the whole thing is not the result, but that we go in the right direction. Sex relationships are, a good field for just mentioning how the transformation is the big thing. The transformation of attitude from defensiveness, fear, and self-contempt, over to faith. Because when we're, do the sex inventory or relationship inventory, where there's the things we look at, I find that being a Catholic and being a professional Catholic, I studied morality rather closely. I got down to every. I probably know the names of more sins than you do. I know all kinds of ways of sin. And the big book, when it does gives a couple pages of commentary on making an inventory of our lives in the sex area, it says we treat sex as we would any other issue, any other problem. And we treat relationships that are sexual in nature kind of the way we treat other relationships. In other words, what we ask is, how have I hurt others or hurt myself? Rather than, what gradation of sin did I commit and how much danger am I in? You know, which could be the self-centered, pious person's thing of getting obsessed with my standing and how guilty I am or not, which is a very unloving thing, you know, a very inconsiderate thing. And the big book's a good guide for that. Just a few comments on different aspects of relationship. One, a marriage relationship. The most god-awful surrender is necessary for two people to be able to stand each other in close quarters. I'll never forget the talking to several couples in a row on a couples retreat. The first retreat I ever did, it's an annual thing, and a lot of the couples keep coming back, and these are not young couples. These are not couples with unstable marriages. It started out with a doctor and his wife, and it was a bunch of other doctors, 7 doctors and their wives, as they call it. And then over the years, they were added and changed, but there were a few of the originals. 1 year, third or fourth year into doing this, several couples came in to talk to me. And they were married in an average of 35 years. And weren't talking about divorce or separation. That wasn't the issue. They had something in their relationship they wanted to discuss. And that was, they were stable. You know, they were sober, long-term members of the program. And after I talked to 3 couples in a row of long-term successful marriages, I was in awe at the depth of pain in a happy marriage. that the... Jean Vanier, a spiritual writer that I admire a lot. He's living. He's a Frenchman who started all this chain of resonances for developmentally disabled people. Very spiritual guy, and he wrote a thing on sex and marriage. And one of his things, comments about marriage, he says the special mode of married love is forgiveness. Doesn't mean you do a bad program and let someone walk all over you, be a doormat. No, no. It's just continuous forgiveness is necessary to keep the ship afloat. I think a happy marriage is one in which the couple, the husband and wife, love each other, are glad they're married to each other, would really miss each other if they were separated, and can barely stand each other. There's just something about a person who refuses to get out of your face. You know, they won't go home because they are home. And the surrender of letting another person be. And I think that surrender can be expressed in the mode of forgiveness a lot. Forgiving them just for being there. Forgiving them for... forgiving them for the way they won't wise up ever. You know, forgiveness. You can say anything you want, be honest, but there's an element of a decision. You know? We kind of have we have a choice of whether or not to forgive the person's presence. And you forgive their presence and forgive this and forgive that. And you can be honest. Say anything you want. Make your complaints. And turn over the results of the complaint. And, of course, the thing I mentioned earlier, what happens when we do totally forgive and turn over, and that is the goodness of that person becomes available to us again. And there can be some fun, you know. In our inventory, there can be, especially from the Al-Anon point of view, it's very difficult. I think it's much harder for an Al-Anon to take an inventory, even though we alcoholics can't remember half of what we did. It's hard because there's so much injury done unto a person who comes to Al-Anon as such horrendous inconsideration, you know, and insensitive, boorish, overbearing betrayals and everything. And I'm getting into it, right? Yeah. Of course it takes, you know, getting into the program, you know, to make the distinction between not being a doormat and standing up for yourself, and while standing up for oneself and being honest, to forgive. That's a distinction we can make well only when we're surrounded by people working the program. We need a lot of support to kind of understand. And so when we put in our inventory, I didn't forgive a lot. Because we say, I didn't forgive this person who's hurting me. That's not my fault. No one says it's your fault. No one's blaming you. But if you get into the habit of having hardness of heart and protecting yourself by being tough in that manner, well, then you just get a little too tough. A little too tough for your own good. And you just get so tough that there's no comfort can get through the defense to touch your heart and be of solace. So we write down, didn't harden, held things against him and was cold and distant. That doesn't mean you're taking the blame, because there's no blame. It's funny, you know, in the boyfriend, girlfriend, relationships, an aspect of the courting or the going out with somebody that kind of tickles me, but it's funny, but it's tragic, is there seems to be social permission to lie and deceive and manipulate anybody that you have a chance of having a sexual relationship with. And you're supposed to be honest and considerate and respectful of everybody else. But if there's a chance, you're kind of allowed to lie in order to make a good impression. So it'll work. Did you know? Do we? There's something about the social permission. And I think that has to be kind of looked at. The and I think, you know, in relationships that are that have some social stigma connected, there's a mild stigma, I guess, connected with living one another without being married. Stigma connected with some with gay relationships, and whenever there's a little bit of a social stigma, it adds a lot to defensiveness. There's a thing. Well, that's not wrong. Well, if someone is accusing us, then we tend to get defensive. And one thing about the program of 12 steps leads us always to a point where we don't have to be defensive, where we can honestly just, God, please help me see what I'm really up to and really doing and what my intentions are, and let me know if I'm hurting myself or others. Because nobody's really blaming us. And so I think when it comes to relationships, say long-term relationships that are irregular in some way by society standards, they're still in our inventory. We look, what's the bottom line here? Not what do they say. How am I experiencing this? What do I say? What's my own conscience? And I think a guide to examining a relationship that's sexual is to take out the sex and say, how do you treat the person as a person if you disregard the sex altogether? And that tells us how we're treating a person as a person. There's a necessity of radical surrender, of being willing for a person to either love us or not love us, or make a decision to go where they want to go or not, where you are honest about what you'd like, but you have to let the person grant them their freedom, or we manipulate and don't treat a person right. It's not good manners. It backfires. The transformation that the program offers us is especially apparent in behavior that we would kind of all, that most people agree is, ooh, pretty destructive. Behavior that's in the sexual area that's, it's a very promiscuous behavior where there's a lot of sex that's really impersonal practically, or that's the kind of behavior that goes along with drinking a lot, you know. And we can say, if there's fear, there's either a bunch of excuses or utter shame and contempt. And if there's faith, there's the attitude that, you know, if you have sex with a lot of different people and you're not ready, you sure have to lie a lot. And there's something about sex where there's a God-givenness to the whole operation, where it seems there's a sort of a built-in message. And two people can be agreed that they're not, this is no big deal, this isn't the answer, we're not going to be a couple. But just after I bought you dinner, though. for God's sake. And there may be an agreement that there's, you know, not much of this. But there's a certain, like, nature, there's a certain given about the message of sexual intercourse. And the given is just, it is a symbolic way of saying, we're in this together. And I care about your whole life, but I kind of care where your laundry is done and what your plans are and how your taxes are doing. And it implicitly says that. You didn't realize that, but implicitly. And when the endocrine system gets secreting certain little chemical messages that go out to the body, and the whole body gets ready to have some security and have some place to rest your head where they don't move fast and drop it. It doesn't matter whether anybody means this or not. The whole system gets ready for some kind of intimacy and love and tenderness. And then when it doesn't happen, it's like getting your chin dropped on cement. And so it's tough. And if a person looks at their own life state with insufficient preparation or whatever, wasn't personal enough, and says, you know, there was some damage to me and other people, and I want to acknowledge that. No defensiveness, no contempt for oneself. So you're in a faith that can be that way, and then we can talk in a way that's healing and not just circular, you know. We started a little late, and I went a little late. I should stop. Usually I stop just before I say anything about sex and get... But I didn't get to the perversions. I had a whole page on perversions, but I don't. Come back next time. Let's pray. Let's see. We pray the Lord's Prayer, then we have the meeting is scheduled at 9.
I don't know.
Do we have a meeting? 8:45. Let's say 9 o'clock. Let's say 9. Let's stand and pray the Lord's Prayer.
This is the end of session 4 and the start of session 5.
My original plan this morning was to have a reflection on the 11th step, which I'm still going to do, and then lead into a meditation that would be a silent meditation, basically, where everybody would go out in the sunshine and walk around. And so I think we're a little bit cooped up here, so we'll probably have a guided meditation for a little while right where we're sitting. It's pretty hot. Oh, yeah, I got... We'll have to get a microphone here next year or something. Okay, the 11th step. Thought through prayer meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understand Him. Praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. This is the step where we... cooperate with our higher power to energize, let grow the spiritual awakening He's bringing about within us. The thing about prayer is not that we need to remind God of anything or kind of get Him on our side or give Him instructions or show how good we are. It's nothing that... And this is not something like some modern reflection, as if I'm saying, dun, 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 the 20th century, we know now that we're not the ones that cajole God into doing things. This is standard spiritual wisdom. St. Augustine in the 5th century had long essays on how our prayers aren't meant to change God at all. Our prayers simply change us so that our hearts are more open to the action. The God's favor, God's love, his way is on. His love is out there. Healing and forgiveness, and that's flowing like a river. That's going on. The only variable in the whole thing is what's inside of us. The only variable is whether I can catch it or not. And if I'm drinking and distracted, I'm in what I was just calling when I have a lot of I gottas. I gotta have this. Gotta have when I got the gottas, I am single-mindedly paying attention to what I figure I need in the way and when I need it, and I simply miss what my higher power has in mind. It just kind of sails by. Kind of got it, but I'm not paying attention to that. I got my hands full. And in our desperation for survival, we kind of do that. And after we begin to have a spiritual awakening and we're drawn into the fellowship and we kind of get wised up a bit and we have our heart healed a bit and we have some people start to know us as we are and we start to have some exchange and it's this wonderful relief where you don't have to put up any pretense. We put it up anyway, just in case. But we can devote less energy to the pretense. And we start letting the spiritual touch, the awakening, have a big effect in our life and guide us. Well, even then, we're in a world with a lot of competing voices. I started out the retreat by talking about how recovery itself can take the shine off of our spiritual awakening by distracting us into all of the advance and the job we're doing and the comparing how well I'm doing. And it goes on and on. There is the risk of making this tape unable to be sent through the mails. I think that this is just, you know, like for educational purposes only. I have to use this word in order to get across the kind of distraction which I think is one of the biggest obstacles to letting our spiritual awakening continue to nourish and guide us. The way this was described is unforgettable to me. There's a guy, I go to my main home meeting is the White Flag Men's Stack, downtown Los Angeles. One of the guys came in one night and he was just saying, oh, I've been listening to K-Fuck all day. I'm sorry, that's what he said, and everybody knew what he meant. Everybody knew that there's a running commentary of self-obsessed fear in the back of our heads. Just this running commentary on how bad everyone else is doing and how unfair life is and how things we probably... He's leaving. There's great competition for computer time, you might call it. The great competition, who gets on the screen? There's lots of people waiting in line to get on your screen. Self-obsessed fear, regular talk radio, the kids, all kind of competing influences and so forth. And they're waiting their turn to get on the screen. And maybe two or three at once are on the screen, so you're kind of looking like this. Prayer has to do with deliberately tuning in to your own spiritual awakening. Tuning in to your higher power and the basis of our own experience of a higher power. So that we're not swept away by listening to that radio station where it just fills our life with negativity and the thing that drains us instead of nourishes us. And as we... Well, how do you do that? How do you tune in? Well, we start to meditate. We listen to God. Well, how do you listen to God? I want to suggest that everybody here has a lot of experience and we're fairly practiced at listening to God. Anybody who's been to meetings on any kind of a regular basis has gotten used to a certain spiritual discipline, a routine. And I call it kind of an active meditation. And when we do that, we simply at a meeting, and somebody starts to share their experience, strength, and hope. And as they're telling their story or going through what they're going to go through, and it's, you know, in a significant percentage of the time, somebody who is sharing their experience, strength, and hope is doing so in a way that we can relate to. And they're doing so in a way where they talk about their life and what happened in terms of the spiritual awakening they had. Now, they may not mention the word God, and they may not mention the word spiritual awakening at all. Probably won't. But they'll simply tell their story. And in the story, if there's a turn in their life where it was from struggling and being negative and despair and total frustration into finding a big relief where they were drawn into this pathway where instead of trying, fighting yourself, there was a turn and a peacefulness where we just kind of relax and someone holds your hand while you get used to being a dingbat alky. And then they give you some suggestions on footwork that makes you more peaceful with that, and then give you suggestions that increase the quality of our spiritual hygiene. You know, instead of constantly hiding, we actually can connect with another person. Instead of being so drained and taken up with our self-obsession, we're drawn out of ourselves to pay attention to somebody else and then find the relief and the freshening up and the relaxation that comes from being let off the hook where I can actually pay attention to another human being. And instead, all those things that start to happen, and then the discovery that we're sober and we don't mind it. I'm sober and I don't feel like I'm doing some big heroic thing. I feel like I'm just fortunate that I get to be clean and sober. I don't have to go through all that exhausting, draining, isolating. Oh, thank you, God. That's a spiritual awakening, by the way, if you don't even think of God directly, but it's rather indirect. And if you're listening to somebody's pitch, and be it AA or Al-Anon, and somebody starts talking about the surprising liberation of do a little workout of release with love. Okay, I release you. I heard one Al-Anon woman one time, and it was suggested to her that she give her husband permission to drink. And it was meant, you know, inside, let go, don't resist the thing. Like, but she walked in and said, I give you permission to drink. You know? And he said, you know, but it was part of her spiritual awakening. She did it. It confused him to no end. He didn't know what was going on for a while. But when we listen to these, to the stories of our brothers and sisters, and in the middle of the story you say, oh, yeah, uh-huh, yeah, you're meditating. You're listening to God. Now, wait a minute. That person isn't God there. This is what I mean. When we identify with the spiritual awakening of another, if someone else's spiritual awakening, and I listen to it, and it rings my bell, if it resonates with the experience I've had, then the experience I've had comes to life. It's raised up on my screen. It has the center. And when it's raised up on my screen, it becomes a more vital thing within me. And then I relate that past event to today. And it has an effect of giving more hope for today and more encouragement to live in the spirit of that past experience. In other words, I'm listening to God. I'm listening to the voice of God that hit me already and that then speaks to me afresh about today, and I get encouragement and direction. See? You're all good at it already. You're all good at meditation. And when we meditate, we do something like that all the time. You use a 24-hour-a-day book, you use another book, and what you're doing is reading something that's a reflection or a report or a reflection on or the result of a spiritual experience of somebody. And if you read the report of someone else's spiritual experience, and if it rings your bell, if you identify it all, there's that thing happens. And as the thing happens, you know, it becomes available to me, and that process goes on, and we listen to God. We can do that in a meeting. We can do that out of a little book. We can do that. There are many forms of doing it. One of the a form of meditation that we usually associate with Eastern religion, Buddhism, or more of a transcendental meditation, is emptying out. By the way, that form of meditation was very common among Christians before the printing press. Since the printing press, we got so much paper. We're reading all the time. And we won't shut up. If we shut up, we'll read. We won't just quiet down and just be in the presence of our higher power with less activity. And so it's that tradition was kind of lost. At least it was thinned out. You know? And I think there are some mantras. I use this, a couple of, I consider them more Al-Anon mantras. They seem to have the best ones. But release with love or release. Let go. These are my two favorite ones. And all by themselves, they wouldn't mean anything to somebody, you know? Release or let go. But if you've been in the program for a while, then we've had 10,000 hours of conversation and reflection on the whole way of life that involves releasing and letting go. To simply say in a meditation with no book or anything else, just sit there and say, release. And then when your radio station is coming in, just say, release. Release. What you're saying is, I want to be quiet in the presence of my higher power. Release. I want to be present in the presence of the spiritual awakening my higher power has been giving me. I don't have access to it all the time, a lot, and I'm so full of today's stuff and my own fears and all of this that I need my higher power to kind of barge into me, and I want to cooperate with this empty, giving a little landing space. You know, just quiet down and give a landing space. And it takes a lot of trust to do that. It means you believe in God if you do that. Because it doesn't make any sense to make an empty space if there's nothing to come in. Just release. Or let go. Or you make up your own one. You know, something that suggests the whole program to you. Or suggest some special understanding you have. And just be quiet. But this, you know, if we don't have time, if we don't take time to just give our spiritual awakening a chance to come up on the screen, well, you know what happens to people who don't go to meetings and don't pray? They get very preoccupied with things, and it's a and if we think of this in terms of fear, the usual way we think in terms of things, of being a little bad girl or a good girl, that's fear. Of being a good girl who prays and meditates, very good. Or bad, never doing that, and then so you get a little star if you pray, and you get a black mark if you don't pray. When we think of those terms, prayer will always be a chore and a sign of being under the thumb and oppressed by rules. You found that thoroughgoing self-acceptance of yourself as both a child of God who is beloved and as a dingbat Alfie or a demented Al-Anon who is full of fear and anxiety, and all of this wrapped together that you live in a way of life where you don't have to subtract the one or the other. You don't have to subtract and hide our pain and our weakness and therefore put on a false front. And we don't have to subtract the fact that we're children of God and live in shame and self-contempt. We put them both together and we know that's the way it really is. That's the way it really is. And when we meet each other like that, and each person we meet, we see a child of God who is pretty goofy and who needs a lot of support, or they'll freak out and pretend they're not goofy or pretend they're not a child of God, one or the other. That we need to keep looking at them, convinced both that they're both, and I got to have people looking at me convinced that I'm both, so that, and when we're convinced we're both, we feel sane. And meditation has everything to do with nourishing that, letting the best we've experienced have this maximum effect in our life. Now, I've just said that from a self-centered point of view, haven't I? I described the benefit of prayer to us. And prayer will get broader than that. It's just something that we do because it's true. You know, whether you're going to feel better or not right away, well, too bad. Who cares? You know, it's important to be in on what's true is that I'm not God. What's true is that the well of love and wisdom doesn't come out of me. It is within me when I'm humbly ready to acknowledge my higher power. And it kind of rises, there's a God within. But I don't own it. I don't own it, possess it, and I don't control it. I'm a servant. And as we, you know, it's just very fitting for us to spend a little time in the presence of the truth and just to do it. Just so that we're not swept away with the lies that, well, with what turns out to be a lie, if that's all we hear. It's not a lie that you're cute. It is a lie that hearing you're cute all the time is going to do it for you. It's get things in perspective. Praying only for knowledge of God's will for us and the power to carry that out. That, again, we get the old fear versus faith here. And I have fear in me all the time. Sometimes when I'm fortunate, the fear is kind of scrunched up to the side, doesn't have too much of an effect. But it's always there. But when my fear has some place in me, and when I read, by the way, to take another diversion here, I find, and I've only been able to acknowledge this kind of recently, that the area where old ideas come in to me most strongly is when I think of spiritual things. Go into a church, start to pray, and you feel more like the old days than any other activity you do. And so it's dangerous. We can get into start praying, think, okay, time to pray, and immediately fall into guilt. Because you haven't prayed enough, you haven't prayed well enough, who do you think you are? And this kind of spiritual K, you know what. It isn't the truth. See, if we can fall into this, it's old ideas. It's the kind of thought process and the little pathways that we've taken a lot when we're thinking in spiritual terms, in spiritual words in our life. I think it's good to acknowledge that, if that's true for you. And to say, just because it will be kind of an automatic association with a lot of our old ideas, doesn't mean that, oh, well, I guess it's just too dangerous for me to pray. I'll think of something else. Maybe high fiber and mega vitamins. No, the prayer has to do with not, you know, it's not designed to get in touch with all our neuroses and old ideas. The whole thing is designed to get in touch with our spiritual awakening that has begun to save our lives, change our lives. And the more we pray and the more we aim it and focus on our awakening instead of the old days, the healthier our prayer becomes and the more nourishing. But the as I look at this thing, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out, what I see, when that'll hit my fear, see? Knowledge of God's will. Ding, 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 ding. And that, I'll think, well, the fun is over. You know God's will. That means, you know, pain. Do you imagine God designing coffee breaks into the into life? You know, we usually don't think of that. And we're pretty sure He'd rather you not have sex again. If you're a particular kind of neurotic Catholic or Baptist. And if it hits us in that fear, that if God's will rings the bell in you that says deprivation, you're going to miss it. All you're going to get now is God's will, so you're probably going to miss out a lot. You know? And if that's the thing, say, oh, that's my fear reacting. That's my fear resonating with what I'm discovering is always from my new understanding of a higher power, from the dumb old God I do have to drag along and give instructions to the higher power who leads me and who's giving me surprises. And it's, we have experience, all of us here. The way God's will is not just something that's just pretty good of us to be willing just to do God's will. No, come on. God's will is what's rescuing us from our will. You know, I had my will long enough. I had a good chance, a fair chance, to work it out my way. And then when I was dropping to the earth, was about dead, I started to be dragged along into God's will a little bit. You know, my will consisted of, you know, pandering to my ego, and because I have a good education, I pandered to my ego in rather sophisticated ways. I didn't want just gross fulfillment. I was after a rather high level of psychological integration and adjustment. I wanted to... I was after that. And I wanted to achieve it. And then maybe I'd be happy. And of course, you know, and I wanted to be good. I wanted to be a good Christian and a good priest. And the way I was going to be able to tell I was a good Christian and a good priest is when I noticed that I was a little better than the other ones. Built-in comparison things. Built-in. And what does that mean when I start comparing? It means that I want to be good. I want to be good. I want to rate high on the scale so that they'll admire me. And God will think you're pretty good. And then I'll be all right. Kind of achieve all rightness by a high rating. You know, and this is fear and ego. It's not the spiritual life. The spiritual life is exactly what everyone here has experienced when you found yourself early in your recovery at an informal talk with some people or in a meeting where you were acutely aware of your disease and of your comical list of fears and self-obsessions, and that you're being held up in sanity and a willingness just to show up by the sheer grace of God and working through other people, and that you knew, and that people could tell that. They could look at you and see you didn't rate very well, and that you knew not rating very well didn't matter at all. I know one of the things I can remember the feeling early when I was going to meetings and just first hitting that identification. And I was sober for a month and a half or something. And people would be sober 10 years, 15 years. And I knew, because I was being touched by the program, my month and a half of being sober, I didn't feel the least bit underdog-like. Or I thought, that's what I am, a month and a half. You're 10 years? Great.
Yeah.
Because we were receiving God's gift, and it just wasn't a matter of comparison. That's not what was going on. What was going on was gratitude for the gift of life and sobriety. And once that's going on, that's the spiritual thing. And when we're, say, into that, we know that we have been drawn away from our usual way of thinking into another whole way of looking at things. And so that then it's God's will. I'm giving an example of getting God's will when we weren't even after it. We're drawn into a way of getting better and a way of life that we weren't even asking for, that we weren't alert or healthy enough to imagine. And it is a sheer gift that we're drawn that way. Or we might have even read about it and idealized about it. A lot of times we get these high ideals, but the ideals are so interwoven with our own fears and insecurities and ego that we want to get we want to be very generous and loving and self-giving and be recognized by all as doing that, or you know, something, you know, just all mixed up with other things. Then when we're given this thing, I just was drawn into God's will. And all I've asked is to sign my name to it. I couldn't think it up. Whenever we find ourselves living God's will, it's a liberation. It's always, it's what I would have wanted if I knew enough. I would have wanted this. I would have asked if I knew. If I wasn't so preoccupied or scared and everything. And that's God's will. God's will for us. And I want to say God's will for us because I am so much of an individualist. I am so detached and sick that I think of well-being in terms of what's good for me. And once we're on this path of recovery, we go through a shift. And we don't think just what's good for me. It's what's good for us. It's what's good for me is when I am relating well with us. What's good for me is to be identifying with you and having your life and what's going on with you important to me. And yet, have clear boundaries where we don't merge and we know that I don't do your chores for you or yours for me, that we respect each other's dignity and individualness, but that I identify with you and that I can't even begin to live my life in a healthy way and take care of myself unless I know we're linked together in fellowship. That's God's will. So God's praying only for knowledge of God's will for us and the power to carry it out. It's not heroic. It isn't ever a matter of being, okay, I'll volunteer.
God's will.
You guys can keep having your fun and everything. I'm going to go for God's will. And Be the scouting party that goes out and lives on weeds and God's will is always what is best, is our true well-being. If there's anything to the thing that God loves us, He treasures our true well-being. Because that's what love is. Love is treasuring the well-being of the other. And He treasures our well-being and He draws us into that. We ask, can you pray for particular things? Should you just always say, God's will be done, and I can't pray that my mother get over cancer or something? Pray for a chocolate-colored Porsche, pray for anything you like. And then say, Thy will be done. Pray for anything you like and then say, Have it your way. Have it what's best for us. I hang on to no results. Thy will be done, Thy will be done, Thy will be done. Keep wising me up, please. I have a feeling this prayer is going to kind of dumb higher power. And I think maybe there's a little ego and selfishness here. But I would like a little upgrade on my hi-fi system. I know the $3,000 could probably feed a lot of people in Ethiopia, but I'm going to try not to think about that between now and the time I go to the store. And if you put some obstacle in my way to stop me, well, I will be done. Because I don't know what I'm doing this for. Thy will be done. We need to be rescued by God's will. A few things, people ask, how can I tell what God's will is? Well, the whole program, the whole way of life we have is designed to give us some chance of recognizing what God's will is. One thing, when the word phrase God's will comes up, is a couple of things I want to say. One is, I think it's always God's will that I take care of what's in front of me. That I simply play the hand that's dealt to me right now. That it's God's will that I handle and take and deal with what's here as best I can in the light of the program, in the light of my own time. Now that may sound like so commonplace. Well, of course. But what I notice myself is that when I get God's will and my expectations kind of mixed up, I'll often have the impression that, oh, it all went wrong already. So it's no use. It doesn't matter what you do now, you screwed it up. That's never the case. Never, ever, ever. There's always something to do that is in harmony with God's will for us. Always something to do that leads. Another thing, if we start meditating on God's will, that's a dangerous thing to do. Because we tend to crawl into the back of God's head and try to psych Him out and figure out what he's doing. You know, when somebody we love is killed, we try to crawl in God's head and figure, what are you up to, God? What were you doing? Well, how come you did that? Well, maybe it was because of this. We get a disease ourselves. We think, well, is this God's will? We try to crawl in God's head and figure out what He was up to. And if you catch yourself crawling into God's head, crawl out as fast as you can, backward. Get out of there. It leads nothing but trouble. We're incompetent to get in there. We just come up with the stupidest things when we're trying to psych out God. It's always going to say, what's God's will for me? Not what's God's will in this transcendent order of the universe kind of thing. Because we're incompetent to speak in those terms. And we just get mixed up. And project dumb things onto God. We wind up with a big, dumb, cruel God. can't quite get the harvest in without killing 70 people. And we need to, what's God's will for me? You know? Anyway. If I'm going to start this a little late, I want to say one more thing about God's will, I think. I guess I said it. One word about formal prayer. Formal prayer has a bad name. You know, what's really good is to speak from your heart and have your own prayer. And that is the highest form of prayer. Is simply discovering the identification that God is speaking to you and saying from your heart. Formal prayer has a place in life, however. And it's a matter of whenever we pray the Lord's Prayer, that's a formal prayer. What that is a distillation of the spiritual experience of your mothers and fathers. It's the well-worn prayer of people who had a spiritual awakening, and we kind of get in on the on an authentic prayer. You read the scripture of your faith. You read some program literature, and when we get in on that prayer, sometimes we are unable altogether to identify with it, and so nothing much comes of it, except the fact that but something always comes of prayer, and that if we stop and simply turn towards our higher power to pay attention, and it doesn't work, it works. If we stop and turn towards our higher power, we're not listening to you-know-what, and we are touched, and it's something like the relationship of husband and wife, of lovers, of very good friends. There are all kinds of levels of intensity of communication, from a very special moment of just clear love and understanding, or down to doing the dishes together, or just having a cup of coffee while both read the newspaper. If you're both having a cup of coffee and reading the newspaper in a friendly, accepting spirit, that's nourishing. And if you attempt to have a conversation that doesn't work too well, you didn't get it across. But if you were kind of earnestly trying to pay attention to somebody, a friend of yours, and it didn't go too well, they know you paid attention to them. And that's part of life. Prayer is part of life. It's regular stuff. It doesn't have to be intense all the time at all. And most of the time it isn't. Most of the time it's like communication with somebody significant in your life. It's a lot of regular old stuff. But formal prayer kind of walking along a path with your mothers and fathers. And when you identify a bit, in fact, if you read your scripture or prayers that are formal, try to have that in mind. That you ask, what's authentic here? What's the good news here? Somebody was turned on when they wrote this, and a million other people identified with it, or it wouldn't be in the book. I want to see if I can ring my bell gets rung with this sort of thing. And then be gentle with it. And if it isn't, it isn't. If it does, it does. But I just want to suggest that as an attitude about form. And now, for the last few minutes here, I'd like you just to have a little meditation. And maybe we could actually kind of squirm around in your seat and kind of get a little more relaxed. And we might even try to close our eyes. And and I want to suggest in this meditation to simply walk along a path and consider what our higher power is doing in us. What our higher power has been doing with us this time since we started recovery. And our higher power has been not so much piling gifts but he's gotten very deep within us and has changed our taste. We who are alcoholic here have a taste for getting high. It's a way of being able to stand it. Our higher power has come and has given us a taste for sobriety. And he's building that taste day by day as we identify with other sober alcoholics. And all of us have a taste for achieving security by controlling. The dream of control. And our higher power has gotten very deep within us, so deep that it's in there where our free will is. He doesn't push us or change us. It's below our awareness. And he's giving us a taste for letting go and granting freedom. He's giving us a taste for trusting the natural process. He's giving us a taste for respecting the freedom and dignity of others. He's giving us a taste for trust. We used to have an ideal of getting everything together right. And that usually did not include other people being in on what we're doing. We're going to do it with them or to them. And our higher power is giving us a taste for fellowship, giving us a taste for the quality of love and understanding that comes about when we gather together freely and wait upon one another, and wait upon the other to share, and we suffer with that person, their struggle to share, and we trust others to let us struggle to share. And it's a lot of times we even doubt the whole worthwhileness of it. But we're getting a taste, and the taste is going deeper for the kind of fellowship and trust and solidarity that we know now, as we're getting the taste more, is what we need to live. And this new taste for fellowship is obviously a gift, because we couldn't get it on our own. And we're getting a taste for loving service. We always liked the idea of loving service, but we spent so much time people-pleasing and being forced to do things and being worried about criticism and doing so much nervously that we're just exhausted and hurt and leave me alone. And we're being drawn into a kind of service that does not deplete us, that is witnessing to the message freely given, and just we pass it on, knowing we don't own it, and yet our own story is a necessary mixture for it to be understandable. And we're getting a taste for spending some time of being in service, and it's kind of a surprise, because most of us are sick of service when it's driven by fear. Our higher power is nourishing and letting the taste for letting go in sobriety, fellowship, service. That's like a seed within us, the yeast into the dough, and the mustard seed. It's in us, and it's growing of itself. given a taste for patience now that their faith is growing. We find more trust in God's loving care when we are confronted again with our own fears, our own powerlessness over our fears and hang-ups. And the old ideas return constantly. Solve our problems in the old ways. And we know that we have a higher power who patiently waits for us to drop the old ways again. And to humbly do footwork while we feel like fools. And we know that no matter what they're doing, presence of God's gift, we can sing a song to give thanks. Not very long, but time is up. We should pray a formal prayer together. I'm going to pray the Lord's Prayer. I think we can just say in rows. It's a little too tough to stand up, but if we get all around the circle, we kind of tear the place apart. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. The kingdom and the power in the glory forever. Amen.
Coming back, it works. Thank you, yeah. Father Terry.